Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Chris Carpenter. We'll talk to Chris about all his wineries, mountain wines, Cabernet Sauvignon, Australia, and more. We'll taste a few of Chris's wine and a vintage treat I dug out of my cellar for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Okay, this is a different intro. I opened this intro with a question, and here's the question. How the hell is a guy who was a Big Ten defensive lineman, still plays the trombone, loves jazz, got an MBA in business at the University of Chicago, which you'd question as a defensive lineman, got another one at UCal Davis in viticulture and enology, and sometimes still bartends during the week? How does this guy make some of the best wines in the world? Well, that's Chris Carpenter, and he'll tell us. He's the Drinks Business Master Winemaker of the Year for 2024. That sounds pretty good, but I don't know what the hell Drinks Business is or what. You'll tell me later. He's been working with Jackson Family Wines for decades as the winemaker for Cardinale, La Jolla, La Jota, and Mount Brave in Napa, and for years now, Hickenbotham in Australia. Chris is that rare air of a high altitude. He's in the rare of that high altitude and highly regarded wines. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Chris.
Thank you, Sam. Good to be here.
We are talking to Chris live in New York City at our friend's office, Colangelo and Partners. Let me ask you the obvious question. Why are you in town?
I came into town to help my sales team here present some of my wines. Yeah,
nice.
We had a couple of dinners and lunches the last 2 days. Tonight we're with some of our collectors. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, so we have a dinner planned with them. And
nice.
A place called the Lynx Club, which I've never been to.
Yeah, I don't know much about it.
Apparently it's a high-end golf thing. I don't know what it is.
Like,
but
yeah.
I had to bring a tie, which I don't oftentimes wear anymore.
Wow. That's interesting. So I was in sales for like 35 years. Did your sales team set you up with a bunch of calls?
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise I fire them.
Yeah.
It's like I flew out here and you have me on two calls.
No. We were at Glenn Vaught's place in Westchester yesterday
or
2 days
ground.
Ago. Yeah, we were up in Oyster Bay at a place called Stellina. A guy named Tom, I can't remember Tom's last name. It was a great dinner.
Nice.
Great dinner, great lunch as well. Yesterday we went to a place called Joji, which is a sushi place in One Vanderbilt. And
oh,
it was
nice.
All collectors.
That's Daniel Balud's.
Yeah, well, I don't know if Daniel is in One Vanderbilt, but he doesn't do Joji.
I think he may be involved. Not positive.
He stopped in. But there's a guy named George who's the sushi chef. Really
I think
good.
He's involved. So these are all obviously key clients, important people.
Yeah.
People. Nice. Yeah. It's nice to hear that you're doing that. All right, let's get into it. Let's kind of frame who you are to the listeners. Grew up around Chicago, right? You did your undergrad at Champaign-Urbana, Big Ten.
Yep.
Said you played football. Pretty big deal. Big Ten football. I'll give you credit on that one. Masters at UChicago. One of the best schools in the country.
Yep.
Right? So normally I have people tell me that and take me forward. Tell me from that point on. All right. You've already got your master's. I'm not sure what you're going to do. But where does the wine thing hit and how does that progress? And bring me chronologically to like today, which is, you know, making wine for all these guys.
All right. So
something.
At Illinois, one of the ways that I supplemented my income was I worked at a campus bar. So I graduated with a degree in biology from Illinois. And when I moved up to Chicago, I needed something to do. I needed to start earning money. My parents had moved out of Chicago years before that. Excuse me. And I start tending bar.
Out of necessity.
And it's something I love to do anyway. And I knew it was a good way to meet people and explore the city. I tended bar at a place that was open till 5 a.m. and a lot of my guests from 11 on were people that were restaurant people getting off of work. And we were their watering hole because we were open that late.
It's a cool spot to, you know, be in.
It was great because these people became my friends and they were working at some of the great restaurants in our area. And so they'd come in, you know, for a Guinness and I'd go into their place for dinner. And we started palling around together, the group of us, and exploring food and wine. Meanwhile, I got a day job. I was working for a medical products company selling hospital lab equipment.
Tell us what. It was sexy.
No, it was blood and urine analyzers. Yeah. It wasn't sexy, but it was a good product and it was a good company. And when I got the MBA.
Was it one of the larger farmers?
It wasn't a farmer company. It was a chemical company out of Germany called Boehringer Mannheim. Yeah, they produced chemistry that docs use to diagnose disease. So I got the MBA and one of the things that started being talked about was me moving into their corporate office, which was in Indianapolis. And I wasn't ready to move to Indianapolis at that time in my life. I was living a very cosmopolitan life.
Chicago's a real city, too.
Well, yeah, and Indy's a good city, but it's a bedroom city. You know, it's where you go to raise a family, and I wasn't there yet. So it got me thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. Like, where I have this moment in my life that I need to take the next step. And if I had pursued that, lucrative, I was doing good in my job, I worked for a great company, but I didn't wake up in the morning and go, blood and urine analyzers, let's go. but I did anticipate, you know, I was still working in the bar. So I loved being in the bar. I loved being in the restaurant industry. I loved restaurant people and the energy. And I wanted to do something that connected me to that. I wanted to do something that I could use my undergrad degree in. I had missed the sciences. I was relating science to docs, but it wasn't my science. It wasn't applied. And I wanted to do something creative. I had left the 5 o'clock bar, which is an Irish club, and moved to a music club up on the north side of Chicago called Shuba's. And this is one of those places, every city has them, that it attracted creative people. So there were artists that would hang out there, actors, musicians, advertising execs, that whole gamut of creative energy. And it was really stimulating. So all these things going on in my head, how do I do something creative? How do I stay involved in the restaurant business? How do I use my science degree? I had no clue. So I took a walkabout. I went out to California. Buddies of mine lived from San Diego up to the Bay Area. And I basically took 3 weeks and made my way north. And, excuse me, last stop was Napa. And you're in these taste rooms, you're talking to servers.
Were you just rolling in or you knew people there?
No, I just rolled in.
You did? Yeah. So you were taking it in for the first time like anyone else.
Yeah. You know, I didn't work at a place. The restaurants and the bars that I worked at in Chicago weren't wine-oriented. Right. So I didn't have those kind of connections.
Right.
But, you know, I was young. I had this is, again, back in the 80s and 90s, and I was working in bars and I was making $300-$400 a night, and it was all cash. Good. So I
it's a good jack.
Yeah, I had plenty to play with. And, you know, you going to these tasting rooms, you go and chat with these people, and you start, everything starts coming together for me. Like, wow, there's a lot of science involved in this pursuit. There's quite a bit of creativity in this occupation. And there's an intimate connection to the restaurant industry, a symbiotic connection. And I started putting all of it together. I'd been drinking wine, but I hadn't thought about it from a technical standpoint. I got back to Chicago.
While you were there, was there a person or a thing that really pushed it forward even more?
No.
Or just the whole package?
It was the whole package.
That's cool.
It was all the different things.
I gotta think about that, right?
Yeah, it was all, it was all the different, you know, you're in Napa Valley, for one. That's where I was at. And it's stunningly beautiful.
It really.
You're going into these tasting rooms. What's that?
You know, more than the now, because it was even a little more pastoral. Or whatever,
you're absolutely right. And then you're, you know, getting the passion that these people were talking about wine under your skin and thinking about how I could do something like this. It was stimulating. And I went back to Chicago. I didn't know how to do it. And this was before the internet, where you could look anything, like, how do you become a winemaker? You can do that easily now. I was really fortunate. I had three or four subscriptions to food magazines. And one of them, there was an article about the program at UC Davis. And I was almost 30 at this point. So
did
I read
you know
this.
That it existed before
no.
the article?
I was clueless. So I read this article.
There was an article in one of the magazines, like, come get your wine degree or whatever.
No, they were featuring a winemaker, and they were talking about.
And it came up there. I got
about Davis and how Davis has set up a lot of winemakers over the years.
And that it's the place, too, for wine out there.
Yeah, well, it is at the time, and you know, I'm a little biased, it was the preeminent school for enology and viticulture. There's been a lot more programs that have spawned from that. Cornell has one.
Right.
Fresno State has one. Oregon State has one. Cal Poly. So, but then it was Davis, and Davis was where you wanted to be. So I called the department the next day. I talked to a couple of professors. I talked to Mark Clear. Mark Clear is a god of viticulture, and I'm on the phone with him talking about winemaking and growing plants, and he's telling me about the program. And I applied and I got in. The interesting part of that is I back in those days, the program was split into two fields. You either went into the enology side or you went into the viticulture side. You had to choose between them. Nowadays, they've combined them. But back then, it was one or the other. And I pursued the viticulture side because of my biology degree. I knew that I wouldn't have to take as many prereqs. I had to take some plant stuff, and having a degree from one of the great land-grant universities, Illinois, going to one of the great land-grant universities in California, Davis, I knew that would help as well. And it got me in the program, and it's informed my winemaking ever since. A lot of my winemaking is based on vineyards and understanding how to grow really
good.
That's
high testament to who they are and what they do for you to say something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that you finish that, you start meeting people, and that's where things...
Yeah, so that's another funny story. So I go to Davis. I ended up being there for an extra year because I took all of the coursework for viticulture. I had to write my thesis in viticulture, but then I took all the coursework for enology as well. So I kind of, that program that they have now, I was doing that before they had that program.
But you were hungry for, you know, info and learning and all that?
Oh, God,
hanging out.
I mean,
you didn't. A lot of times you do school and go, I'm so done with this. I'm out of here. I mean, you wanted more.
Well, and I love school. I love learning. You know,
I guess.
And the great thing about the wine business is
undergrad.
And when I retire, I will probably go back to school in some capacity.
Or teach.
I just love
you have
learning.
Awesome opportunity.
So one of the great programs that Davis offers their students, every year, one student gets to do an internship at Antinori in Italy.
They had the Antinori thing. Was Antinori? It wasn't different every year?
No, it was Antinori.
You can't
beat
that, right?
And I was one of those students that was awarded that internship. So I went to Italy, the last or a semester before I was set to graduate. I had one more semester after that. But I went to Italy and did an internship there. And, you know, that changed my life and got me thinking about food and its connection
to the whole Italian outlook, right?
Yeah.
Were you planted at one winery or were you bopping around Antinori?
No, I was at one. I was at what then was called Santa Cristina Estate, which is now called Tianello Estate.
Right,
so
awesome.
Just outside of Florence. Florence was our city. My wife joined me over there for a couple months during that. And it was life changing. When I got back, my wife, who wanted to have babies, is like, okay, you're done with school. You're done running around.
You're in your 30s.
You got to get a job.
Come on.
So I went to, Davis had a job fair, and I went to the table that Jackson family had there, and there was a guy standing back there, and I had two resumes in my hand, and I handed one of the resumes to him, and I said, can you pass this to the grower relations people for the position that you have open? Grower relations is a job at bigger wineries where you act as a liaison between the winemakers and the outside growers.
Properties and
yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah, so you help the farmers try to figure out what that winemaker wants and the contracts and all that stuff. And as a viticulture major, that was a good foot in the door. The other one I handed to him, I said, listen, I just got back from Italy. I know you have a brand that is based on Italian varieties, and you have a guy named Marco Di Giulio making these wines. I'd love for you to pass this to him. I just want to chat with him because I have a great interest in these Italian varieties. And he looks at the resume and goes, Marco Di Giulio, huh? And I go, yeah. He goes, I'm Marco Di Giulio.
Oh, wow.
I'm like,
that's awesome.
Right on. And he, on the resume, because I didn't have a lot going on, what I had were listed all the different varieties that I had made in my internships up until that point.
Including Italy.
Yeah. So I had the Italian varieties. Right? And I had also worked at Domaine Chandon and Domaine Carneros prior to this. So he reads this list, and there was a variety called Teraldego. And Teraldego is from Trentino. There's a woman over there named
Elisabetta
Foradori. Yeah, Elisabetta.
She's a goddess.
She's a goddess. And he read that I had made Teraldego. He goes, you made Teraldego? I said, yeah. He goes, I made Teraldego. How did you do it? And so we started chatting about Teraldego. And he goes, listen, we're building a new winery in Oakville. I need somebody to help design the lab. Would that be something that you're interested in? I'm like, yeah, I'd be interested. He goes, well, come by on Tuesday. We'll talk about it.
Was that something you said yes to and you'd figure it out, or you really knew maybe you could do something for them?
No, I knew I could do something for them. Okay. Because a lot of what you learn at Davis is the current technology that's available. So I went to his office that next Tuesday. I walk in, and behind his desk, he's got this big poster. And it's the poster of John Coltrane from Make It Blue. I can't remember the name of the album.
Love like, Supreme?
No. But I said,
Giant Step?
I had just bought Love Supreme like a week before. And I said, you're a Coltrane fan? He's like, yeah. I go, I just bought Love Supreme last week. I said, it's a masterpiece. We talked Coltrane for like a half hour. By the end of the day, I had the job.
And you hit it with
him. Yeah. Oh, well, it was, you know.
So what was that? Was that Jackson family, or was that independent of that?
No,
was that a smaller? Was he under the employ of them? Or?
Yeah, so he worked.
And what was the name? Was it La Coya Cardinale?
It was all of that. So he wore the brand that I initially wanted to connect to him on was called Pepe. And Pepe was Jackson family's Calital variety. And that was at a time when everybody was doing Calital because they all thought it was going to be the next white Zin, right? Everybody was looking for the next white Zin. And Calital, Syrah, Merlot, they were all pursued.
That's funny. So the Sutter Zin thing had broken by then?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, everybody was looking for the next thing, right? He also was the winemaker for La Coya, which I didn't know. And he also was assisting the winemaker for Cardinal at the same facility. And there was another winemaker who was making a brand called Adelon. And what he didn't tell me, which was a happy circumstance, was that I was going to be assisting all three of these top-notch winemakers.
Wow.
Each with a different way of approaching wine. One guy, the guy who had Adelon, a guy named Tom Peffer, was a chemist. So he knew chemistry from the beginning of the process to the end and could tell you and taught me a lot about that part of it, which was one of the more difficult things for me to grasp as a biologist, as a chemist. The other guy, Charles Thomas, who was the winemaker for Cardinal, was all about the vineyard and understanding how the vineyard and the product that you're producing in the vineyard, the grape, would ultimately affect the wine, and how you could define anything by way of your winemaking through wine, which spoke to me as a viticulture graduate. And then Marco was the hippie guy. Marco was like, yeah, it's all going to be all right. Don't sweat it. You know, don't, you know, it was, everything was native yeast. And all these guys had their own way of pursuing things. And I had to learn each one of them.
It's good for you to have the multiple exposures.
I synergized it all, you know, and that you can't ask for a better situation. I still thank my lucky stars when I think back to those days and that whole, that half a year or so from going to Italy to having that two conversations with Marco to landing in this place with this opportunity. And that's how I got to Jackson.
So when you look at like La Coya and Cardinale back then, were these wineries like where a husband and wife bought the property and made it and, you know, Jackson bought it, or they built them from the ground up? I mean, how did these?
So Pepe, they did buy. Pepe, they bought from Robert Pepe,
right,
who was one of the grandfathers of Sangiovese. In fact, he was one of the classic stories of somebody bringing cuttings back in a suitcase from Brunello and planting them all over California. He also was one of the first guys to do Sauvignon Blanc. Him and Mondavi were the first two in Napa. So they bought that one. They bought that because Jess wanted to put one of the wines that he created in that winery in Napa, and that was Cardinal. La Coya, they created during that time because they were making some of the wines for Cardinal, and they realized they had two or three wines that just stood out and really defined
from different sites.
Yeah. Which is ultimately what La Coya is about.
Yeah, four sites.
And so winemakers went to Jess and said, listen, we have an opportunity here. That was also at the time when Rosenblum and Ridge had their brands that were doing just that, but in the Zinfandel sphere. Right. Nobody was doing it in Cabernet yet. So that's how La Coya is.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you're doing that. You eventually become, not too many years later, the winemaker, right? Is that from attrition? People leave? You were obviously kicking your butt and took an interest.
That was the thing. excuse me. You know, one of the hardest things for winemakers to learn are the vineyards. It takes 2 to 3 years to really get a vineyard under your skin and know how it reacts to farming practices, how when those vineyards come in, how those fermentations carry on. I had been doing that in tandem with the winemakers, you know, as their assistant. They were teaching me these things. So Marco was the first one to leave. He left in 2000. I was awarded the La Coya winemaker position. Pepe went away. Pepe went to another division, and then we ultimately sold it. Charles Thomas left a year later, and I took over Cardinal. We acquired La Jota in 2005 because it's a mountain vineyard in the neighborhood of the vineyards that I was already overseeing. They asked me to do that. In 2007, we bought the Chateau Patel vineyard, which ultimately became the Mount Bray vineyard, and we created that brand based on that vineyard. And then Hickenbotham, which is the Aussie brand, we bought the Hickenbotham vineyard in Australia in 2012. It has Cabernet on it, and Barbara wanted me to.
Did you jump on that? Right at 2012? All right, we're going to talk about all those. I want to get your take on a few things before that. So that kind of gets us up to current. You know, we'll fill in some of the blanks there. So based on what you told me, I mean, you've been in the Valley almost three decades, if not, you know, more or whatever.
It'll be three next year.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I'm curious, you know, this is kind of a pat question, but I mean, you're the right guy to ask. Give me some observations on the Valley, changes, challenges, trends. You know, what do you see now that, like, you're driving up 29 and there's so much traffic, you remember when it wasn't, you know, what are some of the things that stick out?
Well, I think the pursuit of quality and the understanding of how to capture quality has become even more preeminent in Napa, which is a good thing, right?
Great.
There's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of experimentation and trying to capture the very best of what Napa Valley has to offer is there, and it's healthy. You know, some of the challenges are land prices have skyrocketed. Right. So it's really hard for if you're not already wealthy to start something there. You can't do it in Napa, really.
Yeah.
So that's a bit sad. And those land prices have also created a challenge when it comes to how we house our workers and where those workers are coming from, because it trickles down from these, you know, properties that are worth $40 million to a 1,600 square foot house in Napa is going for $1.5 million.
Jesus.
You know, and the guys working in the vineyard and the guys working in the cellar can't afford that oftentimes. So that's become a big issue that we're trying to address.
Yeah, you forget building. The people a lot of times. The culture and the people are as much the vineyard, the cellar, and the grape.
Absolutely. Yeah. And our company, I think, as well as any company, tries to address that in how we pay and how we house people. Most of my full-time vineyard staff is housed in any number of places that we have throughout the valley. I've got probably 75% of my guys in houses in the vineyard. So, you know, there are opportunities like that. And, you know, Napa itself has – the city of Napa has blossomed.
So I know.
When I moved there, there was one – so I'm moving from Chicago to this rural area.
Chicago and New York are like real city metropolis. Yep. L.A., Dallas don't have that feel.
No, you know? and there was one restaurant in downtown Napa. It was a good restaurant. It was a family Mexican restaurant, but it was the only thing. And they'd roll up the sidewalks around 9 o'clock in the evening.
You weren't used to that.
Napa has, you know, the initial investment that the Mondavi family made in what was then Copia,
right,
and the Opera House and some other things helped to start the momentum of Napa shifting. And now Napa has a dozen restaurants. It's got a music scene. It's got a festival scene.
Stores, shops.
It's a great place to visit. So
that's all good stuff, you know, except, you know, the challenges you bring up are, you know, cost of property, people.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not unique to there, but it's exacerbated there.
We have the environmental challenges that we're all facing.
Well, Napa was pretty good at that a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, I know guys got around it or whatever, but you know, they're conscious. You just couldn't buy a piece of property and rip every tree down.
No,
you know,
which is a good thing.
Yeah. You appreciate that now. The other thing is, you know, you're making cabs, you know, you're making a certain kind of wine. There's no doubt that, like, Napa, and I know this because I was a collector, right? About when you were getting in, I started collecting. Napa was making these high alcohol, fruity, unctuous wines. I think they were pandering to Parker. That was the Parkerization of wine. Is that still what people think and still what's going on? Or are people, some people are moving away or whatever? And then I'm curious, at the end of that, tell me a little about your style, and you may say it varies by the winery, because
right,
I take what, you know, and has your style evolved? You know, has it gone from that hammer to restrain?
Yeah.
So is that what Napa is?
No, there are still a couple producers that are pushing that ripeness curve, but there's a realization we don't need to do that. And there, it would, you know, the thing about wine, and you know this, if you've been collecting for as long as you have been, wine has style and fashion as well. And different wines and different, you know, you think about clothing and the different fashions, the mom jeans are back all of a sudden.
I know.
Fashion kind of goes through these cycles, and that was a cycle of really overwrought wines. And that's, most of that has gone away. My style
Is that because people change too, or it was obvious that this shit's tiring?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I mean, you drink a bottle of 11% alcohol Riesling compared to a bottle of 15% Cabernet, and, you know, it's a whole different thing you're dealing with the next morning.
Right.
And people, that is tiring to a degree.
So you were going to answer the question, but let me set the question up. Did you do that? Were you doing it? Did you have to do it with some? And, you know, now you appreciate or realize these are the type of wines I want to make. So that's leading to your style.
Yeah. I'd be lying if I say that I didn't push the ripeness curve a little bit.
Okay.
But the thing that keeps me in check with a lot of that are where I grow my grapes. You know, when you're growing in the mountains, there's a different calculus when you're making picking decisions. It's not just about pushing this the sugar and trying to get that jamminess, because you're also dealing with acidity and tannin and trying to balance that. So there were some years that I probably pushed it a little bit too far, but most of the time, I'm making the decision on a combination of how the tannins are presenting themselves as much as how the concentration of flavor. And if those things are in balance, that's when I make a picking call. It's not just pushing it to 28 degree bricks and going, okay, now we can pick it. That's not the way to make good wine. And it wouldn't, that end result on a mountain wouldn't come across very well framed, if you will. It would be awkward. My style is a combination of things. Going back to how I studied this field initially was through the understanding of vineyards and understanding that without close attention to farming and how vineyards react differently depending on where you're growing them, that you're never going to make really good wine because you'll never have really good grapes. So a lot of how I think about winemaking is how I think about farming.
Well, you said, I saw a quote or somewhere, the farming and the vineyards, everything, the cellar's 5-10%. You know, exactly it may have been always that way in like the Jura or the Loire, you know, or Burgundy. These guys are farmers.
Yeah.
The most famous guys are, you know, out there farmers and all that. You know, that isn't always the case, but people are talking about it more, which is how important, you know, farming is.
Yeah.
So that's where your attention is. That's where the wine.
That's where it starts.
Yeah.
It's absolutely where it starts. And if you're a winemaker who never makes it in the vineyard, you're not doing a service to your wines or to people that are buying.
I'm going to make this statement. For some reason, it seems like in the older days of Napa, you know, 80s, 90s, 2000s, that there wasn't a lot of attention to the farm. You know, maybe it was a lot of treatment and beautiful rows and all of that. I mean, is that a fair statement or not?
I think there was, it depends who and where you're talking about. But
right.
Yeah, it's become
not fair to generalize.
Yeah, that understanding I think has been proven again and again with people that when you have a good vineyard, you recognize that immediately. So there's that side of it. And then, you know, I make a lot of wines. I make 5 different brands in Napa Valley. I have a brand in Australia, and we're also, with my assistant winemaker, John Aguirre Leducci, pursuing a brand in Walla Walla, Washington.
Cab.
Yeah. All of those have 3 or 4 wines associated with them. It's a lot of wine. So how do I separate them all? It's imperative to understand how place defines itself. And if you're growing really good grapes and at the highest level, when you are pursuing that thought process around place, it's really easy to then define how Diamond Mountain separates itself from Howell Mountain, from Mount Veeder, from Walla Walla, from the McLaren Vale. And making wines of place is my other attention in winemaking, understanding that if I mess around too much on the winemaking side, then I affect that. So when the fruit comes into the winery, keep it as simple as possible. And that simplicity preserves the understanding of place and pays homage to the work that we've done in the vineyard. And that's how I
pick wine. That also go along with different soils, different exposures, different altitudes. So on top of that, you have to manage, you know, but keep place.
And that, you know, we were talking about learning and the pursuit of knowledge and constant learning that this industry has to offer. And a lot of that is just that, learning a new place. When, you know, I was excited when we were going to Walla Walla because it was a new place. When I got the opportunity to go to Australia, it's a new place.
It sounds like you would love that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, another good challenge. You know, off air, we talked about slow food a little, and you were involved with slow food for many years. And obviously you were involved because you believed, you know, in their mission and their values. Did that, being involved with slow food, did that change the way you approached? I mean, you had the farming thing in your head. Did it do other things? I mean, talk to me about organics, biodynamics, treatments. I mean, do you buy into that? Do you do it? Do you not have to do it? You can't do it? You know, and I'm not backing you against the wall.
No, I'm just curious.
Because Napa ain't famous for, you know.
I'm very proud of my time with Slow Food and what I learned from Slow Food and Carlo Petrini, who was the founder, and Patrick Martins, who was both of our friends and who helped start the organization here in the States. You know, Slow Food was about understanding the connection that we culturally have with food and wine, that the planet has with agriculture, and that the diversity of our food system, it should be preserved. And a lot of that is tied into how we treat each other, how we treat our culture, our cultural differences, and how we treat the planet. You know, and as a result of that, I've pursued organic farming in the vineyards that we oversee. The other part of my job is overseeing 400 acres of vineyard. And we are now, at this point, I hope it changes, we are now the largest organic grower in Napa Valley.
Oh, really?
And I say I hope it changes because I hope others pick it up, you know, because we need to be pursuing, agriculture needs to be at the front of the conversation. Because we affect the environment, I think it's between 20 and 30% of the carbon that goes into the atmosphere is as a result of work that's being done on farms around the planet. That's a significant number. To put it in perspective, everybody is crabbing about Taylor Swift flying around to see her boyfriend, because she was in a jet. The transportation industry, including cars and airplanes, is only like between 3 and 4% of the carbon load that goes into.
It's perception, though.
Yeah.
Or lack of
understanding. So agriculture needs to be at the front of that. And so we have organic certification, all 400 acres. We're a step or two away from regenerative certification. In fact, a paperwork.
Well, if you're a farming guy and you've been talking about that, you got to focus and move towards regenerative, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's important.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's more learning, and we talked about the agriculture not only is affecting the environment and the global shift, but it's being affected by it. And if we're not thinking about ways to transform it, it's not only going to be grapes, it's going to be food that's going to get affected, and how we grow food and feed this planet. Right. And ag, I firmly believe that we need to be the leader. And in the grape industry, because we are one of the most under the, not microscope, but more prevalent, talked about part of the agriculture industry because of wine. Viticulture needs to be leading the ag industry. So
it's a good point. You know, it's a high profile thing. I'm glad to hear that, you know, with the organics and the amount of property, you know, and that you're kind of leading the way. I'd be disappointed if it was otherwise. You know, a guy from Slow Food,
right?
You know, he's eating Milky Way and he's spraying whatever. You know, we got to take.
I still have a Cheeto every once in a while.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't? You know, we got to take a break. Before we do, we have about four wines in front of us, and I would like to get to them. You brought three, and I brought kind of a fun thing that'll spark some fun conversation. You brought a La Jota Chardonnay. Tell me about this particular wine.
So this is a La Jota Chardonnay that was planted in 1999. Excuse me.
The vines were put in 99?
Yeah. It is probably arguably one of the last Chardonnay blocks on Howell Mountain. There might be a couple more, but I don't know where they are. But not a lot of people are planting Chardonnay on Howell Mountain. Or if they have it, they're pulling it out and putting Cabernet in. Because the land value up there to have Chardonnay is extraordinary. You know, so in fact, this wine came out of a finance discussion. As the general manager for these vineyards, I was in a finance meeting with our CFO, and he was going through the cost of goods on one of the products, not mine, another Jackson family product that we were supplying, Freemark Abbey. And the fruit from this vineyard was going into this other product, and it was crushing their cost of goods. Because what we do to keep ourselves disciplined is we value that land, and that land value then becomes incorporated into the cost of goods so that we price things appropriately. So we're paying the banks back for things. CFO says, why do we still have Chardonnay in the ground? And as the general manager and somebody who has a business background, I was like, you're right. You know, we shouldn't have Chardonnay in the ground. We should be putting Cab or Merlot in there. But then I never let that drive my decision-making. My decision-making is driven by my love of winemaking. And I said, well, you know, this is the last Chardonnay on Howell Mountain. And if I take these grapes versus sending them to this other wine that was going into a $40 bottle, maybe we can make a wine at a higher level and price it appropriately. And the CFO was like, good idea. Let's do that. And the marketing people were like, yeah, let's do that. And the sales guys were like, yeah.
Kind of solves the problem.
I walk out of the room and I realize I had never made a Chardonnay before.
Oh, really?
I had put my foot in my mouth.
You figured it out.
I did. And I figured it out with a lot of help. I've got colleagues, obviously, in the company. Eugenia Keegan from Oregon. Mike Sullivan used to work at Hartford Court. Now he's Benovia. Jeff Stewart from Hartford Court. I picked all these guys' brains and ask them about their understanding of Chardonnay. And then I went back to my philosophy. This needs to be a wine of place. I want it to scream Howell Mountain. And I want it to be, I don't like big buttery oaky Chardonnays. I love high acid aromatic white wines.
Which I picked up right away. But when you grow Chardonnay, mountain grown Chardonnay, what's the difference? You could make that kind of wine easier with a mountain grown, or that's just still wine. Like we're going to talk about mountain grapes in a minute, you know, smaller berries, more concentrated. How does that affect Chardonnay?
Acidity and minerality.
So good, higher, whatever, acidity, mineral, which is the style that you want.
It's the style
with a little more bracing.
Chablis was the model for this. So very little oak. It's only about 10% new oak. It is no malic, so it doesn't get that buttery character. And it sits on the lees for 24 months.
Wow.
And the lees are where I get that textural component, but it preserves that minerality, that acidity, that more white peach and pear character.
So I was going to ask you, so color-wise, you know, it's got a nice, beautiful pale color. Give me the nose descriptors on this.
Yeah.
What do you get on the nose? I suck at nose descriptors. I know what I'm smelling. I can't describe it.
Well, again, I think you can get that white peach.
You do get the white peach. You get that on the nose and the palate.
Yeah.
What else you got there?
There's a pear character. There's a wee bit of like the tropical, but not a lot. And I don't like a lot of that. Just a touch of that lychee. There's like almost a white pepper background.
I was
going
to say white pepper, white flowers,
cardamom,
or something. Yeah.
You know?
And the mouthfeel is, you know, medium plus. It's not a thin wine, but it's nothing like the, you know, malolactic creamy or whatever.
And that was the goal. And I also wanted a wine that would age. You know, and this wine's going into the bottle at 3.1 pH and an acidity around 0.75 milligrams per 100. And it's meant to age. That
it's good.
Those numbers reflect a higher
acid. I like this
acid.
Kind of wine. So that's the La Jota Vineyards. It's the WS Keys, the vineyard designate, 2021 Chard. Is this in the market now?
Yeah, it is. We only make about 500 cases of this.
Oh,
and
so
most of this gets sold directly to our collectors. Our collectors. A few cases go out here and there, places like New York.
We're going to tell people at the end, you know, where they could go online to check shit out and see whatever. All right, Chris, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Chris Carpenter. Chris is the winemaker at La Jolla, Cardinale, La Jota, Mount Brave, Hickambotham, something in Walla Walla that I forgot. When we get back, we're going to talk about, you know, the specific wines and all of that, and, you know, kind of everything that's involved with it. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Chris Carpenter. So let's talk about your wines, all right? We've been talking about them a little, but, you know, we could sort of get into them a little more. It kind of seems evident to me that you're a mountain-grown winemaker. Like it or not, that's what you are. You're a specialist. Is that a moniker that bothers you, or is
it
inconsequential? I mean, how many guys are, you know?
There's a few people that grow in the mountains. I would like to give Jess a lot of the credit, Jess Jackson, our founder, for
acquiring those properties
in mountain vineyards.
But was he aware of, you know, what the mountains can do, or they were just nice properties?
No.
That's a nice property on the hill.
He was aware. I mean, our Viter property was originally William Hill's property. And, you know, back in the day when Bill was still involved in that property, he was making just stunning Mount Viter wines from this property with structure and natural acidity and concentration. You know, Randy Dunn was up on Howl Mountain when we bought the Liparita vineyard, which we now call WS Keys. So there were some examples.
So Keys was Liparita?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Liparita, the original owner of the property back in the 1800s is a guy named Wilfred Keys. His dad was the first commandant.
WS Keys, right?
WS Keys. His dad was the first commandant of the Presidio in San Francisco, a Civil War hero.
Good
story.
So
there was some, you know, examples, but Jess really picked up on it, and he wanted to put his flag in these
places. Because he did what you described, and you eventually, that's how you got into the mountain thing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you landed with his vision, and you kind of executed with the property.
Exactly.
And
I couldn't be happier, because these are some of the most spectacular vineyards in the most spectacular,
beautiful places.
You know, you
seem like
places.
An inquisitive guy, connected, talk to people and all that. What was it like, I got to figure this mountain thing out, or it's just applying, you know, similar principles,
important. All of that. I mean, I knew that I had different challenges than my colleagues on the valley floor. You know, again, the tannin thing, as a winemaker whose vineyards are mostly in the mountains, you have to be keenly aware of how tannins develop, not only during the
growing
period.
Tell people what the tannins are, where they're from.
So tannins are those compounds when you drink a wine, some people would describe it as a drying character. I like to think of it as a chewiness to the wine. It's the structural side of wine. It's the part of wine that gives you texture and gives you backbone and creates oftentimes a finish that will go on forever. You know, those compounds in mountain fruit are pretty dominant. And if you're not aware of how to develop them in the vineyard and then develop them in the winery, you're going to have really, really harsh wines that are all about that drying character.
Right.
A lot of what we think about when we're making our wines is, okay, that operation that we're about to do, how does it affect the tannins? Those matches of wine to those barrels, how is it going to match with the grape tannin, the barrel tannins? Because barrels have tannins as well. That decision tree is constantly going on in my head, and that's a big part of it. And then, you know, the other—
Oh, wait, tannins? way more prominent or prominent in red wines, right?
Yes.
Do like Chards get the tannins from the wood, or there's a teeny bit?
There's a teeny bit that will come from that. And a lot of these new wines that are aged on the skins that are white wines, right, like orange skin wines, content. those are tannic wines because they're drying from the skins.
Right, right. So what else? That it comes from seeds?
Tannins come from several places.
They don't appear, you know.
No, they come from the skins. A lot of the structural tannins and the drying tannins are coming from the skins. The bitter tannins are from the seeds.
Okay.
So if you have a really bitter wine, it's a good bet that there was a lot of seeds in that. And the seeds weren't managed properly. They can come from stems that sneak through, a lot of the greener tannin. The other way to think about tannin, if you're trying to figure out what that compound is, tea has tannins.
Right.
That's what gives tea its drying character, is you're basically, with tea, you're steeping leaves, and those tannins are coming out. Well, those same tannins are in grape leaves and grape stems. So all of that combines in the melange that's the wine that you're making, and you have to know where you are as far as when they're developing, when those compounds are starting to be pushed out of those raw products into the wine.
Right. So let's talk about the four or five wineries. I was going to start with La Jolla, but I want to come back to that because we got a wine here that, you know, we'll back up towards the end. Cardinale was one of your original sort of early gigs. Kind of a interesting specialty wine. You know, tell me, it's very singular and unique in a way, right?
It is. Cardinale is one of the last
wines. I call it Cardinale, and I know it's called Cardinale, but I can't discipline myself.
That's all right. We have a family in Monterey. They're the Cardinale family, and they own insurance companies and car dealerships, and they come up and buy our swag.
They do.
So it's good Italian.
Yeah.
The Cardinale is an anomaly these days because most wines in Napa Valley now are being produced and reflected by one of the sub-appellations. So, you know, Napa is one appellation, or it's a fancy wine term for a geographic place of significance. We then further divide it into...
Is Napa the AVA? Or
AVA.
So that's how you designate wines in Napa, or the Napa AVA.
Right, but you can also designate them by neighborhoods now. So
like Rutherford?
Rutherford's a sub-AVA.
Is there even below Rutherford, like sub-sub? Or that's how...
No, then you're down into the vineyard designate side of it.
Got it.
But, you know, these are neighborhoods.
So it's like Oakville, Rutherford, St. Helena.
And most wines that are being put out in the market now are reflective of that one sub-AVA. Cardinale is different in that it's several AVAs blended together. Anywhere from, I think the lowest number I've used is 3, and the largest I've used is 10 of the 16 sub-appellations in this one wine.
Originally all mountain, now you throw a little...
That's the other thing. With Cardinale, I do use some of the valley floor appellation. So Rutherford has made an appearance.
Why did you decide to do that? Was that something you were forced to do because of a vintage, or you just thought, you know, this is...
No, it's you know, most of this, my specialty is in the mountains, and the brands that I work with, La Jolla, Mount Brave, La Jota, are concentrating on specific appellations for each one of those. With Cardinale, it's a reflection of Napa Valley, right? So having a player from one of the sub-appellations that's on the valley floor is important from a couple different standpoints. It does reflect the entirety of Napa Valley, but it also adds something that the mountain wines may not have, particularly middle palate. The wines that are being produced in places like Oakville, Rutherford, they tend to have a tremendous amount of middle body. So you can put it into Cardinale and it adds another layer. Think of Cardinale like you would an orchestra. So when you go and see a great orchestra, you just let all of that sound come off the stage and you just enjoy it for its entirety. But you can break an orchestra down. There's the strings, there's the winds, there's the brass, there's the percussion, might be a piano, might be a harp. And every one of those sections contributes something different, right? The percussion is the low end. The strings are the high end. And then everything else is placed by that composer and then interpreted by that conductor to kind of work in a balanced way. Cardinale is that same thing.
Interesting.
It's a symphony of all of these different places in Napa Valley that have their own characteristic as soloists or as sections, but together they're better.
Right.
And that's how I do Cardinale. This particular wine actually is also, and all the Cardinale is a Cabernet Merlot blend. And that's your
how much Merlot? Like 3, 5, 7?
It's been as large as 27%
oh, really?
And as low as 5%.
Okay.
So it just depends on the vintage and how that Merlot
right.
weaves into that particular vintage. Would you like some, by the way?
Yeah, let's talk about it. Let's do this. So this is the 19 Napa Cardinale.
Yep.
Right? This is the current vintage in the market.
This is the current vintage in the market.
And to my recollection, and you'll talk about it a little more, the 19 vintage was a good one, right?
It was a good one. It was a long vintage as far as the growing season. Didn't have a lot of heat spikes. Again, going to the tannin side, there was a development of the tannins in a really rounded way. There's a voluptuousness to 19 and a savoriness that I really find compelling, and I think reflected really well in this
it's
wine.
It's all of that, and you know, it's a big wine in a good way, but none of that stuff that we discussed earlier.
No,
it's,
I don't
it's
like
got
that
a nice,
stuff. I don't because when
really,
you when you push
I mean, the mouthfeel is beautiful. The
yeah.
fruit man jumps right out. So let's do a quick evaluation. It's kind of a dark brooding wine. You know, you put it against the white paper on the nose. I mean, it's fairly classic. Tell me beyond. You know, black fruits.
Oh,
and,
yeah, there's cocoa. There's cassis and
I get cassis more than
there's
cocoa.
There's tobacco. There's toast.
Mm. All
a
good
little
descriptors.
Bit, a little bit of
mouthfeel, you agree, is really a medium plus, but not this, you know, unctuous glycerin.
No, and I don't want
all.
That. Again,
yeah.
with mountains, you've got that tannin, so you got a frame for it. And then you have the acid. And the acid, for winemakers, acid is like salt for chefs. It lifts flavor. Too much. And it would be too...
People complain.
Too little, and it wouldn't have right. that pop of fruit.
That's the art.
And that well, again, that's reflective of the vineyards, because in the mountains, the acid is typically preserved.
So we were talking about mountain wines. Do mountain wines typically always have good acid?
Typically, yes.
More than, you know,
more than
something
the valley
in
floor.
The bench or whatever,
yeah.
Which is a good thing. You know, we love that, which makes it also a good food wine. So this particular wine, how much Merlot did you say was in here?
This one's 10%.
10%,
yeah.
Which is somewhere
yeah.
in between, you know,
yeah.
the 5 and the 27. What? How many sites did you pull from this for this wine?
This wine
you don't
was
have to be exact,
Diamond, right? Spring, Howell, Veeder, Atlas Peak, Stag's Leap, Yountville,
wow.
and St. Helena. So 8 different appellations and probably, I don't know, 14 different vineyards. And then out of those vineyards, I used anywhere from 40 to 50 wines to make this one wine.
So two questions to that. Are those vineyards that are state-owned, or you contract some of them? Or?
So the Stag's Leap, I had 2 vineyards in Stag's Leap. Those are both contracted. We work with the family, the Taylor family, that has an incredible vineyard right on Route 29 next to Silverado Winery.
Right.
And we work with Clos de Vaux on that. The fruit from Yountville was from Domaine Chandon, and they have they pulled this block.
Is that a cooler weather grape, the Chandon ones, or no?
No. This is a Cabernet block that they had in the back of, you know, right behind Dominus, right up against the hill before Blanquiet starts. And it was just a great little vineyard, little rise in the soil, little volcanic
nice.
Rise. And then the Atlas Peak is a contracted vineyard from a place called Edcora, which is another just awesome vineyard. The rest of the fruit in there is estate grown.
Do you... So from your vineyards and even the ones you talked about, For this wine, do you inevitably pull from the same rows, or you're different places, different years?
Yes and no. So there's definitely
there's some
that every year,
and
I
then
know
you'll go hard. To right,
yeah,
which makes sense. All right, so that's the
that was the Cardinal.
The Cardinal, you know, a terrific wine. The story is as good as the wine. You know what goes into it and all of that. Next, we're going to talk about Lahoda, which we're not going to taste, but we'll, you know, talk about it quickly. So that's one of the older, you know, vineyards that was in Napa, which I think would excite you. You know, you walk on the property and, you know, all that crazy stuff. You grow, you do your cab there, you do your Merlot. What else do you do there?
With Lahoda, I make a Chardonnay, which we tasted.
You do a Chardonnay.
We do the...
Oh, right. I'm sorry. We did taste Lahoda. Yeah,
we do a...
my mind.
A Cabernet Franc, a mid-price Merlot, and a very high-end Merlot.
Are you blending anything there, or they're all...
I blend a lot. With Lahoda...
Different grapes, I mean.
Yeah. With Lahoda Cabernet, it's a 5 Bordeaux blend. So...
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Do you have Malbec up? Or you're putting Malbec in?
I have Malbec, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, and Cabernet Sauvignon. And that's dominated by Cabernet Sauvignon. But with Lahoda and Mount Brave, which we'll talk about next, these are wines that are mountain wines that aren't as... big tannin-wise as La Coya. La Coya, you know, part of what La Coya is a reflection of these four places and how they define themselves relative to one another. And in the mountains, a lot of that is the tannin, how that presents itself. Well, that's a good thing if you're a collector and you can sit on the wine for 10, 20 years like you did with this 98. But for a restaurant environment, tannins can be a little bit ponderous and they can swamp the food that a restaurateur might want to match with it. So Lahoda Cabernet and Mount Brave Cabernet are produced with that in mind. The addition of these other varieties helps to round out the tannins. Choosing other blocks that have a softer expression of that, and that's reflective of the...
Is the Keys in Lahoda only Chardonnay, or there's some red stuff on it, the Keys vineyard?
No, Keys has the Petit Verdot. It has Malbec. Yeah. So a little background on these two vineyards. So Wilfred Keys started his vineyard in 1889 and, you know, was pursuing probably white varieties. 11 years later, Frederick Hess rolled in 1898, he planted the Lahoda vineyard right down the road, a mile down the road. And the two of them actually collaborated in 1906 and placed a wine in the Paris Exposition. And 70 years before the tasting that we all think about as launching California wines, Lahoda and the Keys vineyard won a silver in Paris.
Oh, wow.
So we now own both of those vineyards. And as you were saying, you walk in these places, they both have these old wineries that were built back in those days, still on them. One is just abandoned, and we keep it up as a monument. The other one we still work out of, which is the Lahoda.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And just a great property, and Hull Mountain is just a wonderful aviator.
I mean, Lahoda and some good wines coming out of there. All right, so let's move on to Mount Brave, which is something you acquired later, 07, right?
Correct.
Mount Veeder.
So
only Mount Veeder?
Only Mount Veeder.
And
so where Lahoda is
more rustic, rugged, would you, you know, compared to the other ones?
Well, go ahead.
Well, what are the characteristics or attributes different than the other two sites?
Viticulturally, it's a very different soil type
on
Mount Veeder than on Hall Mountain. So Lahoda is based on Hall Mountain. Mount Veeder is based on, or Mount Brave is based on Mount Veeder. different soils, different areas in the valley that get the sun at different times, that get
whole different palette.
Yeah, get different heat and light moments, and all these things, and different aspect. You know, Howl Mountain is on the eastern side of the valley, Beater's on the western side, so they see the sun at different times. All these things drive these differences. My job, again, with this wine, and I make a Malbec, a Merlot, a Cab Franc, and this Cabernet Sauvignon.
Malbec-only wine.
100% Malbec, yeah.
And you blend, like you said. Or do you blend?
No, I do. This again, is five Bordeaux variety blend. A little bit of Malbec, Petit Verdot, Merlot, and Cab Franc in there. And again, it's a it's meant to be a wine that you would get at dinner tonight in one of the restaurants.
This is, to me, this is a little more rustic of a wine. Mm. Not in a bad way. It seems a little more tannic to me. Is it?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. I say stuff and it's like, what's this guy? No. Am I right on that?
No, you are. Because with Cardinal, you've got those valley floor vineyards kind of softening a little bit.
So you want the expression of what's going on up there just to be straight up out in the wine.
Yeah, remember, my wines are about place.
Yeah.
So that has to be
Maybe
seen
a style people, you know, only prefer, and other people like this isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, you've given enough wines to friends where like, it's like, what is this? It tastes weird. It's dry or it's not fruity.
Well, I don't give them wine anymore.
Well, that's how you find out and all of that. So this is the 19 vintage too, right?
Yep.
So this is the 2019 Mount Brave, grown on Mount Veeder.
Actually, this is not Cabernet. What you're drinking is Merlot.
Is it all Merlot?
Yeah, it's 100% Merlot.
I thought that they told me they were bringing it in.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say anything on the label.
Well, it's
in the back, right? Yeah. So this is the Mount Brave 100% Merlot. So that was my question. Is this one of the wineries that only makes a Merlot?
Or we are.
Cardinal doesn't.
No, Cardinal doesn't, but we have Merlot we have two different Merlots under La Jolla. We have this Merlot, and I have a Merlot in Australia under Hickamotha.
But it's not a ton, you know, it's a handful.
We don't make a lot of Merlot.
Yeah.
But we make it, I love Merlot. I think Merlot should be celebrated, not denigrated, and it's
variety. Went through its whole life cycle with sideways and all that.
Right. But you think about Merlot in the Petrus. World of wine, Petrus.
I mean, come on.
Masetto, Le Pen.
I mean, it's crazy, right?
Yeah. So there's no reason that California and Australia can't do that same thing.
All right. So let's talk about Australia. Am I right in guessing that Mount Brave pushes out the least amount of, you know, wines by case or not necessarily?
No.
They're pretty big?
The smallest volume I make is La Jolla.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. But let's jump to Australia. How do you say Hickambotham?
Hickambotham.
Hickambotham. So you had said earlier, 2012, they acquired the vineyard.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because, you know, JFW has vineyards all over the world. Why this one?
This is one of the premier vineyards in Australia.
Were they making wine for themselves or were they selling a lot to other wines that were getting all the credit?
They made a little over the years, but where they really made the vineyard's reputation was selling to other places. So grapes from this vineyard have appeared in Penfold's Grange.
Oh, really?
And Penfold's Bin 707. And the Clarendon Hills Australis and Clarendon Hills Vineyard Designate Wines, Weir is Angelus, Hardy's Eileen's. A lot of really, really good wineries have gotten fruit from this. So we've had a winery.
Has that stopped or they still get a little fruit?
No, we still sell.
You do?
Yeah, we still sell. Right now we sell to, I think Weir is coming back this year. We sell to a family called Becker's. Emma Becker's makes just incredible wines that she gets fruit from our vineyard. Panel gets a little fruit from our vineyard. So high tide rises all boats. You know?
So we said before, it's exciting for you to get on, you know, another vineyard, mountain, cab, totally the other side of the world. what's the difference? I mean, is it distinct or?
Yeah, it's distinct. You know, there's things when I went over there that I had to grasp onto that were similar. So what was similar to me was one, it's Cabernet, and I know how to grow and work with Cabernet. It is on elevation. The vineyard sits at about 1,000 feet at its highest point. So the effects of elevation were very similar for me to grasp onto. The big differences were three main things. One, the soils are completely different. So our average soil age in Napa is about 60 million years old. And it was a combination of the tectonic plates colliding and
crushing up and
starting off all the volcanoes and all these things happening. So we have soils that reflect that. Australia is the oldest continent on the planet, and the soils speak to that. These are 850 million year old soils, Ron. They're compact. They don't have a lot of nutrients. They are weathered. There's a lot of iron in them. So learning how these soils and plants react in them was a good portion of my learning curve there. I was fortunate because about 3-4 years before I got there, a group in McLaren Vale had done a soil study across the region and produced some really great maps. A lot of the guys that were involved in that are still around, and I was able to pick their brains. I became pals with a couple of them. The gum trees. So in the U.S., we have one species of eucalyptus. It was brought in as a hopeful
windbreak. Like Heights is famous for the eucalyptus in the wine. There's a similar effect there?
Oh, God, yeah.
It is.
It's in everything because there's 500 species. So, and those plants are breathing, and our plants are breathing, and they're taking in, you know, those characters oftentimes. And that, you can pick that up in the wine. Here and there.
Can you manage that or just no. It is what it is?
It is what it is. It's you there. Can manage it in the States because you can cut down the trees with no problem.
Yeah, no, not
because they're
weeds.
I
didn't mean it that way. Metal in the cellar, you know.
No. You know, you could probably mask it to a degree.
But you know, that's the site. That's the place.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then the other big thing for me that was a difference was these plants are own rooted, meaning in the U.S., because of phylloxera, which is the root aphid that almost destroyed our industry, all those plants in the U.S. are on rootstock. So they're on an American plant that's grafted to an Italian or French plant, you know, the variety. So Cabernet is on, St. George is the name of a rootstock, right? In Australia, there is no phylloxera in our region, not yet. There's some in Victoria, but not yet in South Australia. So the plants are 100% that plant. There's no two pieces. And they grow
differently.
That's
got to be interesting for you.
It is. And I had to, you know, that was.
Are they visually, like when you think of Napa, you see these gorgeous rolling rows of well-tended. Are these like singular?
Some of them are. Like there's a lot of Grenache grown in our region. And Grenache does really well in a bush configuration.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
So. What are you making at Higginbotham? You're making.
So I make a Cabernet. I make a Cab Franc.
Cab only, or you blend a little stuff?
I might blend a little Merlot here or there and there.
But it's very predominant Cab.
It's dominant big Cab.
You don't put Cab Franc in the.
No, because I have 100% Cab Franc that I.
That you like straight up. I mean, it's that good.
It's that good. Yeah. And then we make a Merlot and we make a Cab Shiraz blend. So in Australia,
it's common there.
Part of their wine heritage is combining those two varieties. And we have the quality in our vineyard to put those two together and create a wine that is that's the high end of our offerings from Higginbotham Reserve.
So how do you manage that? It's the other side of the world. Do you take a chunk out of what you're doing? 3 weeks, 6 weeks?
Yeah, I'm leaving in a week.
Do you go over there and spend weeks?
Yes. I'll be leaving in a week for five weeks.
You're still married?
I'm still married. I think that's what keeps us
healthy. I think that's why,
Keeps us healthy.
I say that. So that's the Higginbotham wines. They sound wonderful. You know, we don't have that here today. We're not drinking everything. All right. We're going to end the wine section on, you know, what's you know, dear and old and original LaCoya, you know, the Marco DiGiulio story with LaCoya and Cardinale and all that. So, you know, I've been a collector for 30, 40 years. I remember buying LaCoya direct from the mailing list. Oh, yeah. And I probably have 9, 11 bottles left. So I said, I'm going to see Chris. Let me see what I have. I have Cardinale. I have LaCoya. I have the La Jota anniversary. Oh. I forgot when that was, maybe 97 or something. But I found a LaCoya 1998, which to my understanding, and you'll address it, was not the greatest year in Napa, but good winemakers make good wines in bad years. But this is basically the year you kind of planted your on your shingle at all right, so let's pour this out and talk about it. And let's talk about LaCoya. You know, the four – oh, wait.
Dump that.
Yeah. You know, set up LaCoya. Look at the colors different, right?
So LaCoya is, you know, if we were talking about Cardinale being the orchestra, LaCoya is the soloist. So it's four wines. Each wine is 100% Cabernet. And each wine is meant to showcase that terroir. That terroir being the fancy word for geography and all the things that make up a growing area. So we make a Diamond Mountain, which this is the 1998 Diamond Mountain.
Is this the Diamond? I forgot.
We make a Spring, a Howl, and a Viter. And what should separate them, if you were to do a lineup of all the same vintage, should be the place, not what I'm doing in the winery. So I try to keep the winemaking across all four of them really consistent so that what you taste is Diamond Mountain. What you taste is Howl Mountain. And that's LaCoya in a nutshell.
So silly question. You know, you got to get to it. So you got four, you know, mountain designates. Are there descriptors that outrightly describe one mountain? Like, you know, the diamond always has, you know, whether it's the eucalyptus or whatever.
Yeah.
Are there things that are so distinguishable in each?
Yes.
So this particular one, let's talk about this wine.
Yeah.
Pour me a little more. I glugged it. I want to know, so we talked about LaCoya. Let's talk about this wine. Were you around in the cellar for this wine?
Yeah, this is my very first harvest at Cardinale.
All right, so that's pretty cool. We're sitting here drinking your first harvest. All right, 1998, this is the Diamond Mountain. So tell me about this wine.
So
tell me a little about Diamond Mountain, because that's what's in front
of me. So Diamond Mountain is in the northern part of Napa Valley. It's just as Calistoga, the community of Calistoga starts. It's the warmest Appalachian.
Is it north of Calistoga or around there?
No, it's just south of the city of Calistoga and on the western side of the valley. It's the warmest mountain Appalachian. It's not the warmest Appalachian, just the warmest mountain Appalachian. So it tends to...
Is it your warmest mountain Appalachian?
Yeah.
Everything we talked about, this has, okay.
Yeah, and because it's in the northern part of the valley. So when that fog drains, it drains from north to south, and it opens
so it's
up that part.
Got more time open, right.
Yep. The wine will show that by way of a more soft character on the tannin. The acids tend to be a little bit more developed in Diamond Mountain. For me, there's always a chocolate-covered cherry with a little bit of mint in Diamond. That's one of the defining.
Where's the mint coming from?
Yeah, it's a good question.
It's not eucalyptus.
No, there's no eucalyptus. It might be a bay leaf thing, but there's a wee bit of mintiness in a lot of how Diamond presents itself. This vineyard was not a state vineyard at the time. This was owned by a guy named Norm Kicken, who moved from Philadelphia to...
Spell his name. K-I-K-I-N?
K-I-K-E-N.
Okay.
Yeah. And Norm sold us his fruit for a number of years. And we started the Diamond Mountain bottling with his fruit. We've since bought vineyards up there that we now farm. But back then it was 100% from what was called the Reverie Vineyard.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day.
Did Reverie become a winery?
Yeah.
Reverie, so saying that's the vineyard?
Yeah. So he had his own winery as well. This is I don't remember exactly, but probably aged in 95% new oak. It is, we used to get between 3 and 5 tons from Norm. And yeah, that's Diamond in a nutshell.
All right, so let's talk about this wine. It's funny, I don't get a ton of oak, but no, I don't know, maybe it's gone or integrated. But color-wise, it's deep, but it's got, you know, that sort of creaking, you know. But held up, you know, color-wise, the provenance on this wine is great. From day one, it's been cellared. So that's not the issue. So color, you know, kind of that, you know, brooding but orange edges. Now let's go nose. Definitely some bottle aging there, big time.
Yeah.
What do you get on the nose? What do you remember, and what has it become?
Well, 98, you know, we talked a little bit about the perception of the vintage, which was not handled very well by the wine trade, because the vintage was a little bit cooler, but it wasn't the end of the world. The vintage had the bad luck of following the 97 vintage, which was considered one of the one of the great vintages of the 90s. But it was a cooler vintage, and by way of a cooler vintage, you oftentimes have more acid. So the acid will preserve the characters. You may not have the same kind of concentration, but that acidity should
carry.
The
luck of having some of the I don't pick it up, but do you get a vegetal quality from everything you describe?
You can.
In that vintage, but it's not in this wine.
You can.
I don't get any of it. What are you getting on the nose?
I get like there's a cigar box thing in there.
Definitely. It's come to that.
There's like a plum character.
Like a ripe plum, right? Almost plum prune.
There's a little bit of rose petal.
Yeah, see, that drives me crazy. It's there, but I would have never thought of that. All right, let's talk about mouthfeel. Still pretty nice, right? Nice mouthfeel on that.
Yeah, it's great mouthfeel. So the tannins have developed, but they're still there. You can still get that structural thing on the side of your palate.
They're soft or smooth or integrated. Yeah. Well, am I right on that?
Why mountain wines age so well is because tannins are preservatives. And how they preserve wine is they're oxygen scavengers. So when oxygen seeps in between the side of the cork
and the glass,
it pulls it out. And when it pulls it out, it forms linkages with other tannins. So ultimately, the tannins will fall out, giving you a softer wine, which is what we have here. It's a softer expression of Diamond because it's, what, how many years now?
25.
Yeah. So it's...
So I'm always curious about this, and how many times do I get to taste the wine with the guy who made it? Who maybe had a clue when he was making it. What do you think? I mean, is it good today?
Yeah, I think I'm really enjoying it.
Whatever the nuance is, I think it's held up. I know the provenance was good and all of that.
Yeah.
The after palate has kind of an interesting, I can't figure it out, but it's kind of nice and interesting. There's nothing bad about it.
No,
and all the qualities are, you know, nice.
And it's getting better. It's opening up in the glass.
Yeah,
too.
It's becoming more voluminous
in the glass.
I keep drinking it. When's the last time you had this wine?
It's been a while.
Has it been?
Yeah, it's been at least probably 7 or 8 years.
Right, so that's the 1998 La Coya. That's, you know, one of the handful of wineries that Chris works with, but, you know, has some history. You know, he was on the ground there, and he was on the ground for this particular wine. So it's fun to taste it with you. I'm glad the bottle's not corked.
I appreciate
your
saying it. This is
for
awesome.
Your sake, I'm glad it doesn't suck either.
Yeah.
You know, it could be vegetal or tannic or puckering and all that. Yeah. I mean, kudos to you. I mean, your first wine and everything. So again, you said La Coya was kind of limited production, right?
Yes.
I mean, what are we talking about?
I make between 750 and 1,000 cases for each one of the wines, so not a lot. You know, this, for me, La Coya is the ultimate expression of these appellations.
Yeah.
And because it is the ultimate expression, I'm very picky as to what goes into La Coya and how it presents itself. So I'm given the leeway to make that decision, knowing what I know about these wines and the vineyards that they're from. So I've never made anything more than I think the most I've ever made of any one of them is like 1,200 cases.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I see it in restaurants. You know, it's obviously mailing list and all that. Silly question. So is like Cardinale La Jolla with all the mountains blended? You've never blended the four La Jolla mountains, have you?
Well, the four mountains are represented in Cardinale.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So Cardinale is your shot.
It's kind of. It's something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right. We're done talking about the wines. Let me ask you some personal questions. Did you go back to bartending or you're still done?
I went back. I bartended until COVID.
And okay.
Then COVID put a...
So that was kind of... You may still be doing it if it wasn't for COVID.
For COVID, I would still be doing it, yeah.
And no temptation to go back to Rutherford Grill or wherever you go?
Yeah, I hadn't had Fridays off since 1984. So having Fridays off is a whole
cool,
new
right?
world. It's this is what a weekend is.
Enjoy it. Were you much of a trombonist? Do you still play the trombone? Were you any good?
No, it was horrible. I was like, it's just a thing. Yeah, I was like the Jack. Was it Jack Benny who played the violin? Played it love, but that horribly.
You were the Jack.
That's me.
I mean, did anyone influence you, like the J.J. Johnsons or the guy in James Brown's band?
No,
Wesley, Steve Turay, a current guy is good.
So, I've been going down to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival for 30 years. It's one of my moments during the year where I get together with my bartending pals from Chicago, and they're all into music, and we all get together. And New Orleans and the influence of the horn in New Orleans is pretty important. I had played trombone as a kid for like 3 or 4 years, and then I quit, and I had other things that were going on. Started going down to New Orleans about 15 years in to the I picked the trombone back up.
Were you into jazz before the New Orleans thing? Yeah.
I'm into all kinds of music. Last night I saw Tedeschi Trucks, and that was something else.
I'm into everything like you are, but you're into one thing that I'm not, and that's probably country music.
Well, yeah.
Listen to it.
You need to start. There's three guys you need to start listening to in country music. Chris Stapleton.
George Strait, Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash.
And Dwight Yoakam. Go ahead.
Rest in peace, Johnny, man. One of the greatest.
I just saw his daughter, Roseanne Cash, two nights ago. She was terrific.
Oh, yeah.
What a band, man.
Yeah.
Sting's
guitars. I met her a long time ago at the musical.
All right, so wait. Tell me what they are.
Luke Bryan.
Good.
Chris Stapleton.
Great.
Tyler Childers.
Don't know him.
Unbelievable.
I'm glad you didn't say Kenny Chesney.
No.
Thank God.
That's a different kind of country.
No, I know that, but I didn't know if that was your thing or whatever. And then the last thing, and we got to do the wine list. We tasted all the wine, so we took that out. The last thing is I was excited to hear that your daughter's going to my alma mater.
To Georgia?
Oh, I thought one of them's going to Wisconsin.
Oh, my elder went to Wisconsin.
Oh, she went.
Yeah, she graduated.
Oh, so she graduated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a Badger?
I'm a Badger from like before you were born.
Yeah, that's great.
Obviously, you visited her there and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Did you go to football games?
Oh, God, yeah. I did the jump around. I did the whole thing.
I mean, Georgia's a great school, but Madison's a nicer looking campus.
Okay, so here's the thing. So I've got two daughters that both picked the exact university that suited them.
And that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Not you vicariously living through them saying, here's where you should go.
Well, but I'm vicariously living through them too.
Well, they didn't pick it through that.
No.
But once they were there, you were.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, the football thing at Wisconsin is some of the best football in the Big Ten. But then you go to an SEC school like Georgia.
It's a different world.
It's unbelievable.
It's a different world.
But I will say this. The community of Madison is such a great place. It's got a food culture.
I know.
It's got
energy. There and be happy.
Oh, totally. Athens is okay. Athens, Georgia.
South.
It's not like Madison. So we miss Madison. But Athens is good. So
it's a good town. They had that sad story about that girl.
Yes.
All right. So that was cool. I was glad to see that. I guess all that studying in the NBA.
What did you study at Wisconsin?
So you know that when Playboy was prominent, they had a poll, the top party schools in the nation. And in the window before I went to college, during and after, Madison was the number one party school 7 of 11 times.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
what I studied. I think they still are in the top three.
When I got there, I triple majored in poli-sci journalism, and I stayed on an extra semester for philosophy.
Oh, right on.
But, you know, and then didn't apply that to anything I'm doing now.
Well, you're kind of doing journalism now.
Well, yeah. I mean, that the discipline there and all that, for sure, which is kind of fun. But I really think that the experience and making the right match with kids, like when you said they pick places that suited them, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's
really, you know, great. All right. So we finished the show with two features, the wine list and the weekly wine sip, where we taste wine. We've tasted everything, so we're not going to. So the wine list is 5 questions. I've asked the same 5 questions to every guest who's passed through here. That's over 300 guests. 300 podcasts. So here's the questions. Don't dwell on them. Don't waste my time. We got to get out of here. Just answer them. All right. Okay. So here's the first question. What are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you curious about? Do you clean things out because the seasons change? Are you curious? What are you drinking now?
High acid aromatic white wines. That is
high acid aromatic white wines. You didn't say Mountain. All right. So give me examples of that.
So Chenin Blanc.
Okay, I love Chenin.
Gewurztraminer.
So wait, Chenin Blanc from everywhere or mostly Loire?
No,
or?
From everywhere. There's a lot of great Chenins being produced in California right now.
They're, a lot it's of coming great, back all and, these grapes, yeah. You know.
Paso Robles has some of the best aromatic whites
even
in
like
the world.
Pax Mali and Sonoma is making Chenin.
Yep.
All right, so Chenin, what else? Give me something else.
Grüner Veltliner.
Okay. I love Teutonic varietals.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to Austria in May to the big fair. All right. So those are good. You ready? Second question. This is the goofiest one in the group. Your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think is great. You know, not what's classic, but what you like. And obviously you don't eat it, you know, that much or whatever. But when you do or you think about it, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Oysters and champagne. What a match.
Brunello and pizza.
Okay. So not the most original or unique, but kind of a bingo.
It's a bingo.
Yeah.
Pizza's my favorite food, and Brunello's my favorite wine.
Like Chianti would be fine and, you know, whatever. But Brunello really has all the body and all of that. You know, it could handle a good wood-fired pizza. It could handle the meat, like pepperoni and all. All right. Third question. You get around a lot. You hang out a little. Tell me about some of your favorite wine restaurants and or bars. And I say this, just throw out places that are good. I don't want you to bump into friends and they go, how come you didn't mention me? These are just, you know, places that either up there, you know, in Napa, in the town of Napa or up the highway and in your travels.
Yeah.
Like today, you know, I know you and I would agree you were at Union Square Cafe for lunch. Good as anything.
That was great.
You know, that checks the box for great wines, great food, great wine knowledge, great wine. Give me some other places.
Kokari. It's a Greek place in San Francisco.
Spell it.
K-O-K-K-A-R-I.
Nobody has ever said that. It's great.
It's awesome.
And wine?
When I go there, I drink Greek wines.
Right.
Gino Mavro, which is the grape variety. It's red. It's
like.
X-I-N. I can't even spell it. It's like Pinot Noir meets Sangiovese. It's such a good variety. It goes wonderful with their food. Anotri in Napa.
It's O-E-N?
O-E-N-O-T-R-I.
Is good?
It's incredible, and it's got one of the deepest Southern Italian wine lists in Northern California.
Really?
Yeah. And if you like exploring, like, wines from Sicily, you know, the wines
which
of Mount Etna.
Is more than a thing now. They're just making great wine. Give me something out of town.
Out of town.
We gave them Union Square Cafe. Give me something else. I mean, San Francisco, in a way, is out of town.
Yeah, I'm trying. I've gone to so many places. It's hard to. Okay, Bayona in New Orleans.
B-A-Y-O-N-A.
Yep. Susan Spicer's restaurant. She's been in business for probably 25
years. And great wine.
Awesome wine
list. An attention to her.
Awesome wine list. Awesome.
Chris, those are good ones. I didn't tell you this, but we post these answers on our social media.
All right.
It's fun to hear, you know, what Chris Carpenter is drinking and all that. All right. Fourth question. Favorite all-time wine. When I initially asked this question, what I wanted to know was, oh, you're Chris Carpenter. You make wine. You know a lot of winemakers. You travel. What's the most expensive rare wine you ever drank? Don't care about that anymore. What's the wine that was transcending, that changed the way you thought about wine, that, you know, got you into it? You know, maybe it was that time we were talking earlier, back and forth from Chicago to Napa. What's an important wine to you?
The 1990 Groth Reserve was the wine that
1990 Groth Reserve. So we're in Napa. Why 90? Why that time? Why that wine?
Because up until that point, most of the wine that I was ordering was in a basket, and it was Chianti, and it was like $5 a bottle. And then a friend of mine who was a server in Little Italy in Chicago said to me, he goes, you got to try this wine. You guys are way too into food not to be drinking good wine with it. And he was right, and that was the wine that he turned
us on. And Groth was really in stride in those years.
Oh, God,
I mean, yeah. They're not – today, they don't get the mojo they got then.
And that was the wine that I tasted it, and the bell went off in my head like, what is this?
That's a good one. That's a good one. All right, last question. This is going to be hard for you. The question is, I want you to recommend to me the best wine around 15, 20, 22 bucks retail. I want you to recommend a white. I want you to recommend a red. You can go category. Like, by the way, Muscadet, Chenin.
Yeah.
Can check boxes. You know, if you go to Loire or other places, they could be. Give me, my kids are in, you know, their late 20s. They can't show up at a party with $12 crappy supermarket wine, but they don't have the jack for 50.
Yeah, right.
So how do you wow, you know, at 20? So think of whites, think of reds. Traditionally, the reds have been harder.
Yeah. White, again, I go back to that aromatic high acid whites. You can get incredible wines for $15 to $25. There's a little wine store, Backroom Wines in Napa.
They've been there forever.
I'll go in there.
Ownership a few years
ago. Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
But the one thing that they didn't change was that they have one of the best white wine sections from Europe in that store. And I'll go in there with a case box and tell the guy to fill it up. Don't even tell you.
Because no one else is curating that stuff
right
in town.
And you can get great bottles for that $15 to $25 range.
So high acid whites.
Yeah. Like
Chenin.
Again, like a Certico or Chenin or Gruner or Tokaj Fruliano.
Albarino. Stuff like that. Yeah. All those are in that category. All right. So that definitely a good answer for white. What about red?
It's funny. I was just at a restaurant an hour ago, and we were talking about Portuguese red wines. And categorically,
that's a solid answer.
Yeah, and you.
But
can
what
get,
are we talking? Like Douro?
Yeah,
or?
Douro. You can get good $15 to $20 bottles. They're not going to have the same kind of structural components of La Jolla, but they're going
you're
to be,
only go so far for 18, 20 bucks.
Yeah, but
they're well thought.
You don't need this every time. And that's the great thing about the wine industry. Yeah. There are ranges of wines across the board that you can explore. So
yeah, those are good ones. And like I said, I posted. One of the things I asked during the wine sip, which we taste along the way, let's just do two things. Let's take Cardinale, this particular vintage, and let's take the old La Jolla. What would be a good pairing for that Cardinale?
The Cardinale?
Is it the steak burger wine, or what else comes to your mind?
Yeah, well, Black Cod would go
Black
really
Cod?
Good with Cardinale.
Because it's rich and fatty.
It's got that savoriness to it.
Good call on that.
Yeah, Cardinale is fabulous with that.
What about a bottle-aged, you know, one of your La Jolla small?
Prime rib.
That's this wine today that we sip with prime rib.
Yeah.
Man, my mouth's watering.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Can I throw like a few French fries or something on this?
Of course.
Okay.
French fries go good with
ketchup.
All wines. Yeah.
All right. That's it, man. We tasted a bunch of wines. We talked about everything. I'm going to give you 30 seconds. Did we miss anything? Is there anything you wanted to talk about? Your new book?
My new book, and my mom keeps telling me I should write a book. I think the thing that I'm most proud of is not only the wines, but the kind of farming that we're pursuing and that we talked about.
I love that. And I love that you talked about culture and people.
Yeah.
You know, and how Napa real estate's so expensive and it's hard for workers, you know, that you address that. And that's, you know, it's on the table as an issue. Because people forget wine is culture and wine is people.
Here's one thing I would say. Don't be intimidated by Napa. You know, a lot of people feel they can't come to Napa because the wines are too expensive or the understanding of wine is beyond them. You know, Napa's got a lot to offer from a learning standpoint that people of any level of wine knowledge should come out and visit us and come and visit us at Cardinal and La Coya.
I think that's a good point. And I think like when I first went there and you first went there, everybody get the same feeling and vibe. So Don't miss that. All right, we got to wrap up. Let me do a quick wrap up and I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your pods. If you subscribe, the podcast shows right up. You know, maybe you're lying in bed and you subscribe and there's Chris Carpenter right next to you, right? It's not a bad thing. Leave a review if you like the podcast. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and on Twitter at BenRuby. I know those are two different handles, but you can always find us at the hashtag The Grape Nation. We're on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we'll post Chris's wine list answers, some cool shit there. And the weekly wine sip this week covered four different wines, three reds and a Chard. All made by Chris, the vintage one, and three current wines, which I think you want to look out for. Chris, if people hopefully are intrigued by all of this, where would they go to find more info on the wines? The websites of the wineries?
Yeah, La Coya, www.lacoya.com.
Everybody has their own thing. Yeah. And even if you went to Jackson Family, they kind of, you know, break them out by region. You know, it was funny. I went on the Jackson Family site and there's like five or six Napa wineries and like 90 in Sonoma.
Yeah, well, that's where most of the activity is.
Yeah, I mean, the land price, all whatever. Yeah. But it's cool that that's there. And what about social media? Are all these guys on social media? Are you on social media?
They're all on social media.
If I kind of put in La Coya, it would show up.
Yep.
And Cardinal and all that. What about you? Are you a Luddite or? I mean, are you on social media?
I am on social media.
What's the handle?
FatCarp73.
FatCarp73. You're not fat, though. What's 73?
That was my football number.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
That's cool. Linebacker, defensive, higher number. All right. I want to thank our guest, Chris Carpenter. Chris is the mountain man making these really tremendous wines out of Napa. Thanks to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.